Hare Krishna. So, I'll be speaking in English.
Last time.
Madhavanand Guru Adikishapur, they said that if I speak in Hindi also, they have to translate everything into English. And I have to translate everything from English into Hindi when I am speaking. So, it just becomes double effort. So, long ago, I had started a series on Shikshashtakam. And I had taken three texts on Shiksha, or rather, three classes on the first two texts. So today I will take the third text, and whenever I come, I will continue the Shikshashtakam series. Okay. Yes. तो अगर किसी को हिंदी में भाषांतर सुनना है तो परमहंस प्रभु पीछे भाषांतर कर रहे हैं वो पीछे सुन सकते हैं. थैंक यू परमहंस प्रभु. सो द थर्ड टेक्स्ट ऑफ द शिक्षाष्टकम इज तृणादपि सुनीचेन तरोरपि सहिष्णुना अमानिनामानदेन कीर्तनीय सदा हरि. द शिक्षाष्टकम इज अ सेट ऑफ एट टेक्स्ट कंपोज एट डिफरेंट टाइम्स बाय लॉर्ड चैतन्य महाप्रभु ड्यूरिंग हिज स्टे एट गंभीरा इन जगन्नाथपुरी. एंड सब्सिक्वेंटली अवर आचार्यज हैव कंबाइंड देम टुगेदर एज द शिक्षाष्टकम. Now, Bhaktivinoda Thakur has written a commentary on the Shikshashtakam, which describes the progression of thought within the Shikshashtakam. So he explains that within bhakti, there are three different stages. There is sadhana bhakti, there is bhava bhakti, and there is prema bhakti. So the first five texts in the Shikshashtakam talk about sadhana bhakti. The next two texts talk about bhava bhakti. And the last text talks about prema bhakti. Now, within this flow, the first text talks about the glory of the chanting of the holy names. The second text talks about the universality of the chanting of the holy names. Now, the third text talks about rising from the state of chanting the holy names to the state of constantly chanting the holy names, or to the state of constant absorption in Krishna in general. The process of bhakti is simultaneously easy and difficult. It is easy in the sense that anyone can practice it. We know there are three modes of material nature. There is tamoguna, there is rajoguna, there is sattvaguna. So, often the processes of jnana, of dhyana or other processes, unless a person is sattvaguna, they cannot really practice it. You sit for hours and hours and study scripture, and that too in an analytical way to try to understand Vedanta. That requires a lot of sattvaguna. Similar to renounce the world and sit in yogic postures for hours, that also requires a lot of sattvaguna. Bhakti, on the other hand, involves variety of activities, and that can be done by anyone. Even if a person is rajoguna, tamoguna, they can just come to a temple and they can join a kirtan. And they can dance and they can experience some spiritual ecstasy. So in that sense, bhakti is universal. That it can be practiced by anyone, whatever be their current situation. At the same time, starting is one thing and sustaining is another thing. So bhakti can be started by anyone, but if they are to sustain bhakti, they need a certain level of sattvaguna. We know that there are these three gunas, sattvaguna, rajoguna, tamoguna, and they are associated with different functions in nature. So tamoguna is associated with destruction. When people are very much tamasic, they can go about destroying things. They delight in destroying things. When people are in rajoguna, at that time they like to create. I want to do new, something new, something new, something new. So, for example, now people want to read books, or they want to read something. They'll read one book, then jump to next book, third book, fourth book, fifth book. That's your jumping. It's largely rajasic. Sattvaguna requires, okay, I take one book, I'll read it from beginning to end. That requires, that maintaining any activity requires patience. Similarly, sustenance in bhakti, maintaining the practice of bhakti requires a certain amount of goodness. And this verse talks about two qualities that are central to the mode of goodness. And of course, these qualities are also pivotal for the practice of bhakti. They are humility and tolerance. Trunad api sunichena, taror api sahishnana. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu draws both examples from nature to illustrate these two qualities. One, he says is that humility like a blade of grass and tolerance like a tree. And concomitant or consequent of these two is amanina amanadena, respecting others, expecting no respect for ourselves. This will lead to the constant chanting of the holy names. So it's interesting that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says constant chanting is not dependent on somebody's strong verbal muscles. You know, like some people just talk on and on and on. They ask, don't you get tired of talking? Can't you be silent for some time? Don't your verbal muscles get tired? Just keep talking. Sometimes if we talk for hours and hours, you know, we also feel, I want to be silent now. So it is not that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is saying that to chant the holy names constantly, we have to do some special exercise of verbal muscles by which we will be able to constantly chant. Constant chanting is not a state of the lips, it is a state of the heart. Certainly, it can be expressed through the lips, but constant chanting is a reflection of the heart's constant attraction towards Krishna. And that constant attraction towards Krishna expresses itself as constant chanting. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is going to the state, is taking us to the state where chanting is not lip deep, it is heart deep. And to have that heart's attraction to Krishna, he says that humility and tolerance are important. So I'll talk 2 points each about humility and about tolerance. So humility means to not let our ego come in the way of our purpose. Humility means to not let our ego come in the way of our purpose. Srila Prabhupada puts it in his 13.8 purport that humility means to not be anxious to have the satisfaction of being honored by others. So it's basically the same thing. But let's see let me explain this. To not let the ego come in the way of our purpose. We all have certain things which we want to do in our lives. And those may be as per our ambitions, that those may be as per what scripture tells us, those may be what we are expected to do as per social norms, as per familial obligations, as per professional requirements, whatever it is. So we have certain purposes in our life. And these purposes, if we are to pursue, often we have to resist distracting forces. Now it is said that an airplane, when it travels from its starting point to its destination, more than 95% of the time, the airplane is off track. The airplane is off track because when it is moving, the very momentum of the airplane puts it off track. And there are atmospheric conditions, there are clouds, there is the motion of winds. So the airplane tends to go off track. And then how does the airplane reach the destination? It is because of constant reorientation. The airplane goes off track and the pilot gets it back. The airplane goes off track, the pilot gets it back. If we see a person who drives a car, especially if it's on a straight road where one doesn't have to take any turns, we may think the driver is redundant. The driver is just moving the wheels a little bit, especially if it's a smooth expressway. Then, especially in the Western countries, I just came from Australia, I had gone on a long 4.5 hour tour, one place to another we were traveling. So, the biggest challenge in Australia while driving is sleepiness. In fact, along the roads in Australia, there are places for power naps. They say that a nap will save your life. So the idea, because the roads are so clear and smooth, the driver doesn't have much to do. And because the driver doesn't have much to do, so drivers tend to doze off. And when they doze off, they just go off the roads. So actually, it may appear the driver is doing nothing, but in the case of a car, there is, by its very momentum, the car tends to go off track. Even if it's on a straight road. And the driver's role might seem to be very little, but the driver has a role like constantly getting the, just moving the steering wheel a little bit this way, a little bit that way, a little bit this way, by which keep the car on track. So similarly, if you want to achieve anything in our life, there will be forces, internal and external, which will take us off course. And we need to constantly reorient ourselves back on track. So, one of the major forces that can take us off course is our ego. So, for example, we are going to do some work and we meet someone and we talk with that person. And then that person turns out to be very unreasonable, very offensive, very disrespectful. And now that will naturally annoy us. That will naturally irritate us. So annoyance and irritation are natural responses when people behave unreasonably or disrespectfully. But if we snap out at them, if we lash out at them, and then we explode in that situation, we may make the whole situation worse. If we had gone, say, for some sort of negotiation or discussion, and if things don't work out, we just stop it and leave. But sometimes, because we pursue things in a particular way, because our ego takes offense at particular kinds of behavior, the ego determines our behavior entirely. And then we often act in ways which are counterproductive for ourselves. So now this does not mean, so humility does not mean that we let anyone and everyone trample on us. We have the the same Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu who is recommending Trinadapi Sunichena Tarorapi Sahishnuna. Now he was very firm when he wanted to do certain things. If he wanted to go to Vrindavan for a pilgrimage, the devotees lovingly told him, please don't go. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu stopped for some time, but eventually he did go. So if he has a particular purpose, he achieves that purpose. And humility does not mean that we let ourselves be trampled upon by others. Now, whatever anybody feels, whatever anybody wants to do, it's like, now there is some cloth at the entry of a room where everyone just rubs their legs so that it's clean. So it's not like humility doesn't mean that we let everyone else treat us like a rag cloth. Humility essentially means that. See, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu talks about humility in connection with devotion, in connection with absorption in Krishna. So for example, if I'm trying to chant the holy names, and if I come into the room and I look at someone and that person doesn't look at me, that person deliberately snubs me. Now if I have come to that place for, say, if I come to a place where I'm going to chant the holy names, now if I get too, how dare they snub me like this? I'll get so worked up that afterwards, maybe 1 hour, 2 hours I'm sitting, I'm not chanting, I'm actually cultivating revenge fantasies. How I will snub that person back in public. So here what has happened, the lack of humility has let our ego sabotage our purpose. So the point of humility is not to let ourselves become a rag for anyone to abuse. The point of humility is to make sure that our purposefulness is not interrupted by others, and especially by our ego's instinctive responses to others. So Srila Prabhupada himself, you know, he embodied humility, but at the same time, when he was sharing Krishna's message, he was fierce, he was forceful, he was determined. So humility means, so for example, say if we are giving a class, and if we find that most of the audience is inattentive, maybe checking some messages or just talking with each other or dozing off. Now, if at that time, if I am driven by my ego, I might just blast off and I might shout at the, I might give the audience a dressing down at that time itself. But suppose it's an audience of new people and they don't really know the etiquette of how to behave in a spiritual program or whatever reason it is. You know, often if exploding while we are supposed to give a speech, which usually most spiritual speeches are about sense control and mind control. So then when we explode, what happens is we alienate people. So if our purpose is to share Krishna's message, then we try to share Krishna's message not just by how we speak, but also how we conduct ourselves. So that humility will ensure that our purpose of sharing Krishna's message is not damaged by the lack of respect over there. But at the same time, it does not mean, humility does not mean that if we are going to a particular place where people are really not interested, it's not that we have to keep going there again and again and thinking that, oh, because nobody pays attention to me, that will make me humble. That is not humility. That is masochism. Masochism means just hurting oneself. So Srila Prabhupada, he was preaching in India and he found that Indians had some sentimental appreciation for sadhus, but they had no interest in becoming committed. So then what did Srila Prabhupada do? He did not think that, oh, just by preaching in India, I'll become humble. No, humility alone is not the point. Our point is, we have a purpose. The purpose is to share Krishna's message. So Prabhupada found, okay, if Indians are not interested, he went to America. And then when Americans came back to India, then he found that, yes, people are not taking it seriously. So humility means to not let our ego come in the way of our purpose. Humility doesn't mean that we don't have a purpose itself. You know, anybody tells me to do anything, I'll do that. Anybody treats me in any way, I tolerate that. I endure that. No. Humility means we have a higher purpose to our life and we don't let lower things distract us from that purpose. That's one aspect of humility with respect to how we deal with others. Now, another aspect of humility is about how we look at ourselves. The purpose of humility is to foster neediness, not helplessness. Now, humility is meant to increase our awareness of our need for Krishna. Humility is not meant to make us simply feel helpless and powerless and hopeless. We have a certain amount of capacity to do certain things and we also have limitations to our capacity. Whatever we may have certain ability to sing, we may have certain ability to speak, we all have certain different abilities. And we also have certain limitations. There are some things which we can do, there are many things which we can't do. So even the things which we can do, we often find that there are others who can do it better than us. And even the things which we can do, we may not always be able to do them equally well. Cricket is a popular sport in India. And in cricket, often it is said that, say, a batsman is out of form. No batsman wants to be out of form anytime. But then it's just that even if that person is a champion batsman, it's not that batting is always under their control. So the point is, humility is an awareness that there are certain things in our control, there are certain things beyond our control. And even the things which are in our control, even to be able to do them, we are not alone in doing those things. We need higher sanction. We need ultimately Krishna's grace. So our awareness of our need for Krishna, that is what is the crux of humility. So sometimes when people are very self, sometimes humility can become an excuse for self-pity. That means people say, oh, I can't do this, you know, I'm like this, this is what happened with me, I'm so fallen, I'm this, I'm that. Well, if we are interacting with some other people and we keep telling them, I am so fallen, people say, I am not interested in what you are. Now, why should the world have to stop? All that it is doing is to hear that I am so fallen. Now, people are interested in what we can contribute to them. So, sometimes, what we can contribute best is, most of the times, what we can contribute best is, we can help them to recognize their need for Krishna. And in that connection, we can tell also how we need Krishna, how Krishna has played a role in our life. So there is self-absorption and there is Krishna-absorption. And humility is what enables us to make this journey from self-absorption to Krishna-absorption. Self-absorption means I'm always thinking about myself. Now the thinking of myself can be in two ways. One can be how good I am, and the other can be how bad I am. How good I am, it is self-centeredness, or we could say it is egotism. I can do this, I can do that, I have done this, I have gone here, I have done all these things. That is self-absorption, where we are the center and we are thinking how great I am. Now self-pity is also actually a form of self-absorption itself. And this is actually the key difference between humility and inferiority complex. Inferiority complex is self-centered. It is self-centered in the sense that, oh, you know, I can't do this, I can't do that, I can't do that. Oh, there's so many things wrong in my life. What can I do? So it's self-centered. Whereas humility is centered on some purpose higher than ourselves. Ultimately in bhakti, humility is centered on Krishna. So a devotee's focus is that, yes, I have my limitations, I have my deficiencies, I have my drawbacks, but still I'm a part of Krishna. And if I try to do my part in a service to Krishna, Krishna will help me. So humility is not about feeling helpless constantly. Yes, we can feel helpless about our limitations, but we should be. The purpose of humility is to shift our focus from our helplessness to Krishna's supreme helpfulness. So the focus should always be Krishna. The focus is not how I am, how good I am or how bad I am. So in that sense, humility is not meant to make us feel helpless, not meant to increase helplessness. It is meant to increase neediness. So this is especially central to the process of chanting, because as long as we think I can do anything, any problem that come, life comes, sends my way, I can deal with it. If I'm thinking like that, then what is the need for chanting the holy names? What is the need to call out to Krishna? Namo akincha nivittaya nivritta guna vittaye. Kunti Maharani says that you are akincha nivittaya. She says in the Shrimad Bhagavatam 1.8.27 that you are the property of the impoverished. And she says if we are too filled with how good we are, janmaishwar shuta shrubhir edhaman madha kuman naivarathya vidatum vaitvam akincha gocharam. And if I think, oh, I am so intelligent, I am so good looking, I am so wealthy, I am born in such a high family, and what do I need God for? So this is the opposite of humility in the form of self-absorption. And this prevents us from focusing on Krishna. So our focus is on whatever purpose we want to achieve in our life. And humility is an aid to that purpose. So in this case, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says that to come to the state of Kirtaniya Sada Hari. Now the word kirtan in a limited sense refers to chanting. And that chanting also we can say the chanting the holy names of Krishna. But kirtan in a more inclusive sense refers to the glorification of Krishna. And glorification of Krishna can be through chanting, it can be through music, it can be through speaking, it can also be through our living. When we live our lives in a way that is meant to share the glories of Krishna with the world, that is also kirtan. So humility enables us to come to that level of focusing on Krishna. Focusing on Krishna because we recognize that we need Him and because we want to serve and glorify Him. Now we'll move on towards tolerance. Tarorapi sahishna, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says. So I'll talk 2 points about tolerance. Tolerance means to call off our war with reality. Tolerance means to call off our war with reality. War with reality means all of us are in particular situations in life. Say for example, if I was supposed to come here for the program. Say I am coming from a short distance, but suppose I was coming from the Chowpatty temple and I am driving a car and I suddenly get lost and I end up somewhere else. Now if I simply start cursing myself, why did I take that wrong turn? Why did I take that wrong turn? How stupid I am. How this, what, that. Now okay, if I have gone on the wrong track, just cursing myself is not going to get me at the right place. So, I have to accept the reality that I have gone off track. If I resent the reality that I have gone off track, then I waste my energy which I could have used to come back on track. So, often in our life, now here I give an example of a person going off track by their own mistakes. But sometimes, life may also take us off track. No, we want to do a particular thing, say we want to go for an urgent meeting and suddenly along the way our car breaks down. Now if I am just frustrated and shouting and resentful and furious, You know, that resentment, often resentment of reality hurts more than reality. Yes, my car has broken down. If I just find out what to do, maybe I can call some friend, or maybe I can just hire something and just make sure that his car is stored and kept somewhere safe. If I just think calmly, I can move onwards. But when I get consumed by resentment, then that resentment of reality often hurts more than reality. So tolerance means to call off our war with reality. And this is what Chaitanya Krishna also says this, when he talks about the tolerance, trunadapi sunichena, matra sparshastu kaunteya shitoshu sukadukkadaha agama apayino nitya stamsitiksha subharata. That he says that just as when the seasons come, sometimes it is too hot, sometimes it is too cold. Now we really can't do much about this. Yes, we may have AC, we may have fans, but if we are going out, at that time we just have to endure the weather, whatever it is. So he says that just as we, the thrust of this message verse is that just as we endure external changes by knowing two things. First is that they are unavoidable. Yes, it's hot. Well, I can't do anything about it. Second is they are ephemeral. Ephemeral means that is they are temporary. It's hot, it's not going to be lifelong hot. It's a hot season, there's going to be a cold season afterwards. There's going to be a comfortable season afterwards. So, just as we tolerate unchangeable external things, similarly, Krishna says, tolerate unchangeable internal things also. What are unchangeable internal things? He says, sometimes you may feel good, sometimes you may feel bad. Sometimes we wake up in the morning and we feel enthusiastic. Yes, I want to do a lot of things. I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to do that. Sometimes we wake up and we feel as if, you know, getting out of the bed is like lifting up a huge mountain. Just don't feel like doing anything. So now when these feelings come, at that time, we need to tolerate them. Tolerate means what? Not that just because I don't feel like coming out of bed, I don't come out of the bed only. That's not what it means. Tolerance means that we don't resent why I am feeling like this. Okay, I am feeling like this, that's how it is. But let me go on. So now to call off our war with reality does not necessarily mean accepting things as they are entirely, forever. If we see, some people think this is the next point about tolerance. Tolerance is not passivity, it is maturity. Passivity means, oh, you just tolerate anything and everything that people do or whatever happens, you just passively accept it. That is not tolerance. Tolerance is maturity. What is this maturity? Maturity to recognize what is unchangeable and what is changeable. So now if the Bhagavad Gita's call for tolerance had been a call entirely for passivity, then how would we make sense of the fact that Krishna is asking Arjuna to fight the war? Krishna is not telling Arjuna, now the Kauravas have done so much atrocities, you just tolerate them. Tam sitiksha sobharata. You know, Draupadi was disrobed, tam sitiksha sobharata. Your kingdom was taken away, tam sitiksha sobharata. That is not where tam sitiksha sobharata is applied. So, tolerance is not passivity. It is maturity. Maturity means to maturely choose our actions. So immaturity can be in, again, two ways. Immaturity can be in terms of inaction. Immaturity can be in terms of impulsive action. Suppose, for example, something goes wrong in my life. Some people just become inactive. Meri kismati phooti hai. Always things go wrong with me. Nothing is going to work on me. And people just become, they get sink into depression, they develop even suicidal thoughts sometimes. So all that happens because that's one, things have gone wrong and inaction. I can't do anything. So immaturity may be reflected in inaction. And immaturity can also be reflected in impulsive action. Impulsive action means that just my feelings, my passing temporary feelings, they just determine what I do. You know, something goes wrong and I feel so, sometimes say there's an important cricket match going on in India, lose a cricket match, people just break their television set. Now, you know, the TV is not the problem. isn't it? So that's immature. It's impulsive action. You know, this impulsive actions can go to terrible extents. There are instances, you know, especially in Sri Lanka, it happened about a few years ago. That in Sri Lanka lost the World Cup finals. At that time, there were 7 fans who committed suicide. Okay, cricket fan match losing is you may feel bad about it, but to commit suicide for that, this is what that means. You know, just can't accept the reality. So tolerance means to call off our war with reality. If you can't accept the reality, then what? The impulsive action can go to any extremes. So now, tolerance, I talk about 2 things here. One is accepting reality, not calling off our war with reality. Now this does not mean that we are passive. As I said, the Pandavas did fight a war, and war is very assertive action. So normally, when we face an unpleasant situation in our life, at that time we have different options. Broadly, our options fall in 3 categories. One is just live with the situation. Second is change the situation. Third is walk away from the situation. There are 3 broad options. Suppose, you know, we are living in an apartment where there is a very noisy neighbor. Now what do I do with that noisy neighbor? There are 3 options. We just live with it. Okay, this is how they are. Or we try to change it. We talk with them. We talk with the building apartment managers, secretary or the chairman or whatever. We try to do something. They're playing loud music, blaring at late at night. Then that's disturbing us. Then that through that things can be changed. Or if we find that person is very incorrigible or too influential over there, we might just decide, okay, I will take a house somewhere. This is an extreme step. But the point is, these are 3 broad options we have. To live with it, to change it, to walk away from it. Now, walking away from a situation is not running away from the situation. And when we run away from a situation, our primary focus is, hey, I just don't want this. We are scared of the situation. And our focus is what we are going away from, not what we are going towards. So, essentially, we all in our life have to choose our battles. Choose our battles. That means that there are hundreds of things that are wrong around us. If we try to set everything right, you know, everything will go wrong with us only first. We will become so burdened, this, we will not be able to do anything. So, we have to choose. Okay, this is something which I feel it's very important, and I feel that I can change this, so I work on changing this. This is something which is important, but I can't change it, so I just live with it. This is something which I can't change, I can't tolerate, I'll walk away from it. So we all have to choose our battles. And in different situations, we may respond differently. We may live with something, we may change something, we may just walk away from some things. This will all vary. But the maturity to think about the situation and to choose our battle, that is tolerance. And this tolerance enables us to focus on whatever is important for us. And if we don't have tolerance, suppose you say we are going for an important meeting and then along the way we are driving a car and somebody just cuts us. I mean, you start seething in anger and blasting at them, shouting at them, how dare, you know, this driver is so lousy, you know, the Indian traffic system is so lousy, India is so lousy. You know, I just make a big thing out of it, and by the time I reach for the meeting, I'm so boiling that I can't speak anything coherently over there. So what has happened is that small thing has made a big, big problem for me. So tolerance is what enables us to keep small things small. To keep small things small. And we'll see that the mind is expert in making small things big. And this is a big way in which the mind distracts us from chanting. It distracts us in life. Now we are sitting and chanting and suddenly we see someone coming into the room. We think, hey, you know, that person, 6 years ago he has promised to do that for me, but he forgot to do that. Well, we had forgotten that for 6 years also. But now we start remembering that we think, hey, this person is irresponsible and yet they're so respected. Maybe I should push that pull the person down a peg. Maybe I'll tell this and tell that, and then we find that, you know, maybe 1 hour is gone. Or 15 minutes are gone, or whatever, so much time has gone. So keep small things small. Tolerance is what enables us to do this. This does not mean that all things are small. There are many things which are big, and they do require big attention. They require big action. But the capacity to differentiate between small things and big things, that is what tolerance empowers us to have. And thus when we do it, then we can focus on glorifying Krishna. So tolerance, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we see, he wanted to glorify Krishna. He was a Krishna himself, but he had come to teach the process of bhakti. But we see that he chose his battles. When Haridas Thakur was in Jagannath Puri, at that time the existing Brahminical orthodoxy, it held that a person who was outcast could not enter Jagannath's temple. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu chose not to fight that battle. He declared Haridas Thakur to be Namacharya, and he ensured that even in other ceremonies, such as where the food was being served, he was given precedence. But in this particular sense, he said, this is not important. So he neglected that. So there are different times when different battles are to be fought. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was working in the British government, and in his writings, he chose never to criticize the British government. He was quite sympathetic. He focused on the fact that earlier when the Muslims were ruling, at that time, we were not even able to do our temple worship and our kirtans well. Now we at least were able to do that. So he focused on the good that was there in the British government. So there will be different situations where different things need to be focused on and certain things need to be neglected. And that capacity is what enables us to do something substantial. The Bhaktivinoda Thakur used his position in the British government to actually bring respectability for Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Because at that time, a person who was Indian educated, working in an influential position in the British government, that person was respected in society. So now Bhaktivinoda Thakur at that point had started agitating against the British government. Then he would have been not only in professional trouble, but also he would not have had the position to bring respectability to Gaudiya Vaishnavism. So yes, the British government might have been doing many things which were bad, but he chose not to focus on them. He chose his battles. And then he was able to glorify Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Krishna through writing so many books, through attracting so many people, and through creating a lasting legacy of bhakti. So like that, for Kirtaniya Sadahari, for glorifying Krishna, we all need to choose our battles, and tolerance enables us to choose those battles. So I'll summarize. I started by talking about how in the Shikshashtakam, this verse is a part of the 5 verses that talk about sadhana bhakti. And this verse talks about moving from beginning chanting to steady chanting. That requires sattva-guna. And sattva-guna involves tolerance and humility. And we discussed about how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu for glorifying Krishna constantly, chanting Krishna constantly, he doesn't talk about the verbal exercises, because he's not talking about lip chanting. He's talking about a heart devoted to glorifying Krishna. And that requires being able to stay focused on a higher purpose. So that is what humility and tolerance help us to do. So we discussed 2 points about humility. Humility means to not let our ego come in the way of our purpose. In the way people behave, we have to respond appropriately. And it's not that we let people disrespect us constantly. It's not that we let people trample on us. We see what is our purpose, and we see how best we can behave in a way that serves our purpose. So I discussed about if we are speaking and people are disrespectful, what do we do at that time as an example? And humility also means, humility is meant to increase our neediness, not our helplessness. It is not that in the name of humility I feel, oh, I cannot do any of this, I cannot do that, I cannot do that, and I just end up feeling sorry for myself. So, just as we understand if somebody is very positively self-absorbed, thinking I am so great, I am so great, I am so great, then that we understand is clearly not humility. But the opposite of that, negative self-absorption, oh I am so fallen, I am so this, I am so that, that is also not humility. That is also actually just the same ego reflected in the opposite way. Humility is meant to shift our focus. Humility is meant to propel us in the journey from self-absorption to Krishna absorption. And along that journey, we need to recognize our need for Krishna. Even the things that we are good at, we need Krishna's mercy to do those things. We discuss how a batsman is maybe champion batsman, but they are not always in form. So even the things we are good at, we cannot do them without higher grace. And the things which we are not good at, certainly we need Krishna's mercy for being able to do those things. So humility is meant to increase our neediness for Krishna, not our helplessness, not make us feel sorry for ourselves. And then tolerance, we discuss two aspects. Tolerance means to call off our war with reality. As long as we are resenting whatever is happening in our life, we can't do anything positive about it. If I have gone on a wrong road and I have ended up at a wrong place, then just resenting, cursing myself, it doesn't help me get to the right place. Or if somebody has snubbed me or somebody has cut across me while I am driving, just ranting at them doesn't help me. Now, calling off our war with reality doesn't mean that we accept things as they are passive. It simply means we recognize that this is how things are, and resenting them is not going to help me. Resentment of reality often hurts more than reality. So once I accept that this is how things are, then I have various options about how to deal with them. We may live with it, we may change it, or we may walk away from it. All of these are viable options depending on timeless circumstances. And we need maturity to choose the right options. So humility is not passivity, it is maturity. And in maturity we discussed how the Pandavas, Krishna tells Arjuna to tolerate the heat and cold, tolerate whatever pleasure and pain he might experience while fighting against his relatives. But Krishna is not telling Arjuna to tolerate the atrocities of the Pandavas, of the Kauravas. So we fight over there. So we have to choose our battles. If we try to change everything, we end up actually burdening ourselves in intolerance. So we choose, this is what I can change, this is what I want to change, work on, and we work on those things. And our life of glorification of Krishna, Kirtaniya Sadahari, we can do that consciously, we can do that substantially when we choose our battles. Certain situations we just neglect, certain situations focus on them. We discuss how Bhaktivinoda Thakur chose not to criticize the British government, because he could use the position of the British government to share Krishna's message. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu chose not to criticize the Jagannath temple administration, even though they were not allowing Haridas Thakur in, because Jagannath Puri was his base, and from there he was able to bring so many people towards Gaudiya Vaishnavism. So we may all have to choose our battles so that we can become full, we can become successful in fulfilling our purpose in our service to Krishna. So thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yes, please. You can ask, then you can So, do non-devotees have no good qualities, and do devotees automatically have all good qualities, as the verse from the Bhagavatam seems to say? Actually, I gave a full Bhagavatam class on this topic in Radharas Vihara temple once. So we have to look at the context of this verse. The context of this verse is the temporariness of everything material and the eternality of the spiritual. This is a whole sequence of verses going on, and various paths. So the Bhagavatam in this context is saying that path of jnana is ultimately not of much use. The path of yoga is not of much use. The path of karma is not of much use. It is the path of bhakti alone which will lead to eternal gain. So in that context, the Bhagavatam is saying that what is the value of good qualities? And the path of jnana is given in scripture itself. The path of yoga, other paths are also given in scripture. And they do have value. They do lead to elevation. But from the ultimate point of view, they cannot satisfy the heart's longing for love. Yaya atma supra sidati. That cannot happen. But contextually, they do make a difference.
The thrust of that Bhagavatam verse is that ultimately people may have good qualities, but if they don't have devotion to Krishna, they are not going to attain lasting happiness, they are not going to get lasting liberation from material existence, and they are not going to achieve life's perfection. So it is from the ultimate perspective that this discussion is talking about. We see in the Bhagavad Gita itself, when Krishna talks about a Brahmana, he talks about the qualities of a Brahmana in 18.42, and he says, Shamodamastapa Shaucham, Shantirajamayamacha, Jnanam Vijnanam Astikyam Brahma Karma Subhavacham. He's giving a list of qualities. This is the qualities of a Brahmana, and he does not mention bhakti as a quality of a Brahmana. He talks about the several lists. He talks about the qualities of Daivi Prakriti in the 16th chapter. And he does not mention bhakti as one of the qualities over there. Abhayam Sattva Samshuddhi Jnana Yoga Vasti 16.123. He doesn't talk about bhakti. So now he's talking about, and there are examples of Brahmanas who have other good qualities but who do not have bhakti. Now in the Bhagavatam, they are reproached. But it's possible that there can be people who may be intellectual, there can be people who may be disciplined, there can be people who, as you say, are humble, who may not be devotees. So we cannot use this verse to claim that nobody who is not a devotee has any good qualities. Now, where qualities are present, we have to give them due credit. They are present and we appreciate the presence of those qualities. And the Bhagavatam also talks about people who have good qualities. For example, the Bhagavatam says Vena, he was charitable, but he was not a devotee. And that's why he is not really glorified in the scriptures, the way Yudhishthira is. Yudhishthira was charitable, but he was also a devotee. But the point is, the Bhagavatam recognizes that Vena was charitable. So people can have qualities. The point of this verse is that those qualities are of no ultimate use. And in contrast, for as far as devotees are concerned, you may see sometimes devotees may be proud. Now, they may be lacking in humility. So we have to understand that bhakti is a curative process. It is a curative process that can free us from all anarthas. But that does not mean that a bhakta right now is free from all anarthas. The point is, because they are practicing bhakti, they will eventually develop all good qualities. But it is not that right now they have all good qualities. The example that Bhakti Samrat Sindhu gives is like a raw mango and a ripe mango. The raw mango has the potentiality to become ripe, and in due course of time it will become ripe. But I cannot wish away the reality and call the raw mango as the ripe mango. The two are different. So it is very much possible, and it is actually real, that many times devotees have less than desirable qualities. And we cannot deny that. At the same time, we should not obsess over them and neglect the fact that they are devotees. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that if you find that some devotees have qualities, they are chanting Hare Krishna but they are not having proper behavior, then we should respect them from a distance. If somebody's negative qualities agitate us too much, we can just keep a distance from them. But it's not that devotion is a whitewash immediately. Ultimately, devotion will wash off all anarthas. But right now, as bhaktas, we have to recognize that this is a curative process which will take time. And in the intermediate, we have to function in a way in which we are productive and whatever we are part of is productive. Now, if somebody is an irritable person, now if we put them in leadership position, it's going to be a big problem for everyone, for them and for others. You cannot say that because they are devotees. So if people right now may have certain qualities, may not have certain qualities. And we need to engage everyone according to what the way they have qualities. And presently, we need to deal with people based on what kind of qualities we can gel with. So there's another principle is Sajati Ashastrikta Sangam. That Rupa Goswami says that we should associate with like-minded devotees. That means if certain devotees have certain qualities that just disturb us too much, then we need not associate with them. If we can associate with those who are like-minded, those whom we can understand, who can relate with, those whose wavelength matches with us, and in that association we will blossom. So, does it answer your question? Thank you. Yes, please. Last question. Yeah.
Great. So, how do we draw the line on a practical level that, as you said, between self-pity and humility and between passivity and maturity, when we are in a situation, how do we individually know, even if we look retrospectively, that whatever decision was done at this point of time, or whatever we have done, maybe at whatever point of time, whichever situation, this was done out of maturity and not passivity, and was done with humility and not self-pity, or arrogance.
Yeah,
and
correct.
On a practical level, I mean,
yeah.
Theoretically, we...
I understand. So, you know, how do we practically draw the line between the self-pity and humility, or passivity and maturity? If we have done certain actions, how do we evaluate? And how can we ourselves choose? Yes, just as it's a matter of appetite. How much should I eat? You know, I learn by experience. Okay, I think this much food will be enough for me. Sometimes I may find that that was not enough, I may take a little more. Sometimes later I may take a little less. And then afterwards, I ate that meal, that was too little. Or that was too much. We learn by experience, but it's not just by experience alone. Experience plus introspection. Hey, okay, I'm just feeling so lethargic after I ate that. Probably that item I should have eaten a little less. So just as eating is something, it doesn't come with formulas. Nobody can tell us, you should eat only 2 chapatis, you should only eat this much rice. No, nothing like that. We all have to learn ourselves. So like that, what level of assertiveness we should have in what situation? That will depend on a lot of things. Just as a diet, what works for me may be very different from what works for you. So similarly, different people are comfortable with different levels of assertiveness. So for example, a person is a Kshatriya mentality. They want to change things. A person of a Brahmana mentality, they may want to just tolerate things and walk away from things. You know, I have other things, I have better things to do in life. I don't want to fight, get involved in all this. So we can't make a rigid formula that this is what it is. It is now in our own thoughts, patterns, and our own priorities also change with time. So what may have seemed reasonable earlier may not be reasonable now. So in this case, three things from a practical perspective. First is that we sometimes are forced to make certain decisions which need to be urgently done. Should I do this or should I do that? Now there's some petition. Should I join the petition or should I not join the petition? Whatever it is. So we might just make some decision based on our gut feeling. But afterwards we observe. Afterwards we observe. And usually when we look back at the past, the usual tendency is to let the mind be in control. I mean, I'm just doing some work and suddenly, hey, only if I had done that, it would have been so good. So then that is simply lamenting. Now, lamenting about the past is very different from learning from the past. And the primary difference is who is in control. When the mind is in control, the mind makes me think about this, think about that, think about that. Oh, I did that mistake. Oh, I did, if only I had done that over there, I had done that over there. So when the mind is in control and is dragging our thoughts here, there and everywhere, at the end of it, we simply feel bad. We feel depressed. But learning means, first of all, we situate ourselves in goodness. Now maybe we chant, we pray, we read some scripture, we may take some deep breaths, whatever. Situate ourselves in the mood of goodness. And then consciously take our thoughts behind. Okay, this is what happened. This is what I did. What did I think when I did this? That's what I thought, but maybe I didn't think about this factor, or I thought, but I did not think this factor was so important. So try to reconstruct our thought process, and then we understand where our thought process was inadequate. So that calm deliberation of our past actions, okay, even if you made some mistakes, it's okay, but we need to calmly deliberate, not just lament over the mistake. Then we can learn from it, because we have to not just look at our actions and say this was wrong and this was right. We have to look at the thought process that went behind that action and not just say I was so stupid at that. No, why did I, what was my thought process when I did something? See, even when we act in a stupid way, and we do all act in stupid way at times, but there is, at that time it doesn't seem stupid. So at that time we had some, the mind provided us some kind of reasoning by which the unreasonable appeared reasonable. So we have to deconstruct that reasoning of the mind. and then make sure that we don't fall prey for that same wrong reasoning again. So that calmness in looking back at what we did in the past is important. And this can be done not just for our past mistakes. It can also be done for our past good things. Sometimes we just take some impulse, some decision based on gut feeling, and that turns out to be a very good decision. So we can learn from that also. Okay, in this situation I thought like this, this was a good way of thinking. So that's firstly, first thing is learning from the past. Second thing is with dealing with the present situation, it's very good to write our, if a situation is of significant importance to us, it is good to write down our thoughts. Now writing down our thoughts in a journal helps us to have a snapshot of our mind. So for example, if in a particular situation, you know, the nature of the mind is to keep us dissatisfied, whatever situation we are in, you know, if I have this job, or I have this position in this job, you know, this is the problem, this is the problem, this is the problem. I shift to some other role, there will also be problems. The nature of the mind is to keep us dissatisfied. But there are different kinds of dissatisfactions. There is some dissatisfaction which is just because of the irritability of the mind. There is some other dissatisfaction which is because of genuine incompatibility. Now I'm just not fit for this job. So when it is genuine incompatibility, then that feeling is persistent. Whereas it is just of irritability, it just comes and it goes. So if we have to make a major life decision about what we should do, then we keep a snapshot of our mind by writing our feelings at periodic intervals. So we decide, okay, this is the issue which I am going to decide about. Then once a week, I will spend 15 minutes and write down my feelings about this. And then if any other time the thoughts come, I am not going to spend my thinking about it. Spend time thinking about it. Because that is simply a waste of mental energy. Should I do this? Should I do that? Should I do this? If I get some new thought, I might just note it down briefly somewhere and then put it in my journal later. And then if we do this for say a significant amount of time, 2, 3 months, 6 months, and then we observe, you know, consistently, this is what I'm feeling. This means that if the same feeling goes on consistently for a long time, that indicates some fundamental incompatibility. So there we may need to change. Make some change ourselves, walk away from the situation or change the situation, whatever. Other thing, if it's just coming occasionally and going, wherever we are, there are always going to be problems. So we may just decide that, okay, sometimes I get this irritation, sometimes I get that irritation, and this is something which I'll have to live with. So the second aspect I would say is that keep a journal and keep it for a significant amount of time. Don't just let the mind wallow in that thinking constantly, but allot some time for that thought, for that subject, and give focus time in that time. Third is to get a third person perspective. That if we consult a counselor, we consult some senior devotee, and what happens usually for us, say I am here and there is some situation out there. Most of the time we evaluate everything through our mind. You know, this is a lousy thing. This person is like this, like that. So we always evaluate everything through our mind. Now, if we have even one person in our life whom we can trust more than our mind, that is a matter of great fortune. That means when that person speaks something, it's not that we evaluate them through the mind, we evaluate our mind through them. That means my mind is saying, you know, this is, you know, this person is so bad. But then this person is saying, you know, you are also not behaving properly. Then, no, you are taking side, you are on that person's side. So, no, if we have trust in that person, then we will start evaluating. Okay, this is what this person is saying, and this is what my mind is saying. Then, having that kind of, if we have even one person whom we can trust that much, it's a matter of great, great fortune. And it's not easy to have one person like that. And sometimes you may have to consult multiple people. But the point is, we can't take major decisions based on our perspective alone. Ultimately, we have to take our decisions. But if we rely only on our perspective, and we talk only with those people who reinforce our perspective, then it becomes a big problem. No, Kaikeyi's problem was twofold. When she got Ram exiled, her first problem was she heard mantra. And second bigger problem was she did not hear anyone else. So we should not. So if we are going to take a particular decision, we can hear from those who reinforce that decision. But if we know somebody is also having the opposite perspective, at least we can give them a hearing. And by getting these outside perspectives, we can evaluate our feelings better, and then we can arrive at a mature decision. Does it answer your question? Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki, Shiksha Ashtakam ki, Shri Gauranga Mahaprabhu ki, Jai Gaur Premanande.
Thank you.